It is not an easy thing to go against the policies of your government. It's not an easy thing. It is particularly a difficult thing with this government because they seem to take names and remember who you are. That's unfortunate. Because the great driving dynamic of democracy is that you're allowed to have a different point of view. And you need to respect other people's points of view. And that seems to have been lost. When the United States decided to invade Iraq, I supported the president's decision. But I've come to regret that support. Because this war has not gone well, and the consequences are unknown, but we know they're very great. But to oppose a president, his administration, and your country's policies is a difficult thing. Our two guests today have demonstrated courage, have demonstrated a degree of independence which we can only admire. I will introduce them both now. They will speak, obviously, separately, and then we'll have a dialogue at the end. Our second speaker will be a young man who founded AfterDowningStreet.org, has done some remarkable things. And we look forward to hearing from David Swanson. But we're going to begin with a woman who spent 29 years in the United States Army and 15 years as a United States diplomat. She was based in Ulaanbaatar when we went into Iraq, and she wrote a remarkable letter resigning her position in protest of the war. We're grateful she's here. We're grateful that Mr. Swanson's here. Please welcome Mary Ann Wright.
Thank you very much, George, and Reverend Smith, for your vision of having an opportunity for people of San Diego to get together and talk about issues of importance for us all. It's particularly great to be here because this is a military town, and I've been in the military half of my adult life. I value very much my time in the military. I became a colonel. I was an airborne colonel in the Army. I kicked butt all over the place and then did a different kind of kicking around in the diplomatic corps. I've really been in diplomatic or government service all my life. I've served under seven administrations, and I've served in times when the policies of the United States, perhaps for you as an individual, you said, "What in the world are we doing on this particular policy or that particular policy?" And I too, as a government employee at various times during various administrations, held my nose to some policies that I, as an individual, felt were not helpful for America and probably weren't helpful for the world. But I, like a good bureaucrat, held my nose and found a niche in the government that I could go ahead and serve in and feel that I was contributing to something. But after 35 years and long service, I found a topic that I, or a situation that I felt that I could no longer represent an administration on. And that was in March of 2003, I submitted a rather lengthy letter of resignation. I've been in the government 35 years, so I thought, yeah, at least I could give them a page for every decade I'd been in government service. So I submitted a 3.5-page letter of resignation detailing my great concerns about the direction the Bush administration was leading our country, and particularly on the war in Iraq, going into Iraq. I felt that we as Americans were going to suffer greatly if our country went to war without doing it in a legal fashion. That indeed we needed to meet one of the three criteria for having a legal war, that one of which is getting the approval of the UN Security Council. And the United States had gone to the Security Council and couldn't get the Security Council to agree to a war on Iraq. Nor was it an imminent threat, direct threat to the danger or to the security of the United States of America. That was one of the other criteria. And also there was not a genocide going on or some humanitarian disaster of such great proportions, such as Rwanda, that the international community needed to step in immediately. And without having one of those three bases, I felt that America was going to be on really thin ice, that indeed that action was going to create conditions that were going to encourage young men and women throughout the world, but particularly in the Muslim communities of the world, to dislike America even more than they did, and perhaps become like those people who on September 11th decided to strike out at America. So I was saying that going to war in Iraq under the conditions that we knew at the time was not going to make the world safer. It was going to make it more dangerous. And as we found out later through the Downing Street memos, which I suspect David will clue us in a little more on, we found that indeed from March of 2002 that indeed the United States government had been discussing with the British government the need to go into Iraq. And the British government itself had said, well, we don't have a legal criteria to do that, and we'll have to fix the intelligence in order to do it. Well, I went ahead. I felt I cannot represent America when it goes to war in these conditions. And that's after being in the military for a long period of time, having gone into places like Grenada, Panama. I was part of the operations in Somalia. I helped open embassies in Uzbekistan. I was in Kyrgyzstan. I was in Sierra Leone, was the acting ambassador when we had to evacuate 2,500 people in 1997. I volunteered to be on the first team of diplomats to go back into Kabul, Afghanistan in December of 2001 and stayed there for 6 months. So, I've been around the block on military operations, on crisis predicaments. In Afghanistan, I was there to see that, in fact, the full force of the United States was never brought to bear on the situation in Afghanistan, that indeed the people that had committed the acts of September 11 and whose bases were in general in Afghanistan were never really met with the force of the United States of America, that indeed we were already starting to move. At the time, we didn't know it in Afghanistan. We were wondering why we didn't have more U.S. military that were coming into Afghanistan. Why was Washington telling us that, no, we cannot expand a presence outside of Kabul, that we cannot have a U.S. military presence in all the major cities of Afghanistan, that, no, we've got to slow down on economic development. We just can't quite get moving too fast on it. Well, as we found out later on, there were already plans afoot to go into Iraq. Well, all of this led me to resign, and that kind of comes to a small topic of this. Dissent in a democracy. What is our obligation? What are our responsibilities as citizens? And as our earlier colleague from the city council says, what are the ethical dilemmas that government employees face when they're faced with situations in government service where they feel that there is something that's going on that you think is wrong and perhaps illegal? What do you do? Well, for me, as I mentioned before, a lot of times I held my nose and I went about my duties and did nothing while other people in the government resigned. In the Foreign Service, we've had a series of resignations over policy issues. In Vietnam, we had Foreign Service officers that resigned. In Bosnia, we had Foreign Service officers that resigned because the U.S. government was not doing anything. And those resignations and then later letters from Foreign Service officers that stayed on active duty saying, you, the administration, the Clinton administration, had better get doing something because there are horrible things going on in the former Yugoslavia, and we, the United States, have to help resolve this thing. The war in Iraq, there were three diplomats that resigned, three U.S. diplomats. I was the last one to resign. How did we all come to that conclusion? Why did we finally step out of the mold? Because there were only three. You know, there are a lot of people that are still in government service that have not chosen to exercise their rights of dissent. Well, there are a lot of good reasons, and many of them were presented to me in the first days after I resigned when over 400 members of the diplomatic corps emailed me at my last post, which was in Mongolia. Not a real hotbed for U.S. foreign policy, I will admit, but after coming out of Afghanistan, I kind of wanted to go to some place that I hope was a little calmer. Well, anyway, over 400 of my colleagues emailed me to say, "We are proud of what you've done. It took a lot of oomph to go ahead and make that big decision, and we aren't able to do that yet. Those 400 said, we are very, very discouraged about what's happening, the image of America in the world because of going to war in Iraq, going to war in an oil-rich Arab country that has not done anything to the United States, and for us to go in and invade and occupy that country. We who are experts in the field of foreign affairs know exactly what's going to happen. All hell will break loose. We will not be greeted with flowers. The first group may have flowers, but then there will be an organized resistance. The people of the foreign affairs community knew what was going to happen. But those people said, I have to stay in the Foreign Service because I've got a mortgage, I've got kids in college, I've got responsibilities, and I can't give up this job. And besides, and I think more importantly, I'm going to try to work within the system, and I'm going to try to moderate and ameliorate the policies of the administration. There are things that we can still do within the government service that perhaps can get our country back on a more even keel. And thank goodness they did stay, because we don't want everyone who disagrees with every policy to bail out. Otherwise, no matter what administration it is, it opens up the field for the packing of the House, for political appointees to be put in not only at the highest level, which happens in every administration, but it then opens up a large number of positions to political packing, positions that are served by long-term federal employees who are loyal to whatever administration that is elected by you, the people of America. And sometimes, as I mentioned, you hold your nose to some of the policies that an administration has. Well, I wish my colleagues very good luck. Unfortunately, I feel that they probably are very sick at heart and probably all have ulcers because I don't believe they've been able to influence the administration at all on the war in Iraq. And that personally leaves me with a very heavy heart because I feel this war, and as we now see how it is going, has done nothing to enhance the safety and security of America or the world. It's a war that, in my opinion, we the United States need to back out of. We need to end our involvement quickly because we are the causers of the violence, the recipients of the violence. And as long as we are there, that level of violence will continue. Not to say that if we remove ourselves that all violence will stop, because we have by our presence there and our dismantling of many of the governmental organizations of the former regime, not to say I'm an apologist for the former regime, but there were structures in place that could hold people together to give you time to rework the political system. But with the dissolvement of the army and the police, those are the people who knew where to go to get the ammunition and the guns, and they're in great measure the ones that are tragically killing our own citizens, our American and coalition soldiers. So my take on it is that we, the American military and government, need to back out of Iraq. I know that's not a popular statement in a lot of circles because for some people it means that we are showing that we are chickens, cowards, that we can't cut the mustard, that we can't do this, that, or the other thing. But I think if you look at it on another level, you have to recognize that this is not going anywhere. It's not doing anything for the reputation and prestige of America. And in fact, it is putting us so far into the international doghouse that it's going to take a long time to get out. I truly believe that it is the responsibility and obligation of us as citizens, if you feel something like that, that you have to stand up and speak out. And it truly isn't easy. It is not easy at all. Because as a government employee, I mean, I have served at the will of the people of the United States, and to voice my opposition to what has happened with the will of the public as expressed in elections, to stand up against that is hard. But when you really look at what your loyalty ought to be toward, should it be toward the elected officials who perhaps have been misguided, misled, have been lied to, or have lied to America, or should you be more loyal to what America is, then that's one of the reasons I think we have to protect our right and obligation to be dissenters in a democracy. Thank you very much.
The Iraq War is a pure war. It is a war for the sake of war. Congress is debating whether to spend another fortune on it, another fortune that could completely remake this nation if spent on useful projects. And Congress has no reason for the war. The reason is purely that the media might not like you if you vote against a war. But there's no actual reason. There's not the weapons of mass destruction that Bush always knew were not there. There's not the ties to 9/11 that Bush always knew were not there on behalf of a leader who, in any case, is no longer in power. There is not the reducing of terrorism in the world, which has been increased dramatically by this war. There is not improving global relations when this war has pushed the United States to a record low in global opinion. There is not the preventing of a civil war, which this war and occupation have created. And there is not supporting the troops when the majority of the troops want to come home and almost half of them openly admit to pollsters that they don't know what they're there for. So this is a pure war. But the vote for more funding will not be a pure vote. It will include nothing that the Iraqi people need, unless you think they're longing for bigger prisons. But it will include all sorts of crumbs for good projects, for Katrina relief, for VA benefits. And there will be a lot of excuses that Congress members can use to vote for this money, taxpayers' money, for this war. Any Congress member who says that they are doing so because of these crumbs, if they are not co-sponsoring Jim McGovern's bill, which simply and cleanly says no more money for the war, then they are a hypocrite. And so let's be clear. An aggressive war without UN sanction, as Ann said, whether it's marketed on a mountain of lies or not, is a crime and is the legal equivalent of mass murder. Of course, we all know, and we should remember, since we've been told enough times, that Bush had no idea that he and his staff had promoted lies about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction and ties to 9/11 and punished anyone in the government who opposed those lies. Bush had no way of imagining that so many experts who said the Iraqis would resist a foreign occupation would turn out to be right. And we know from recent reports that Bush could not possibly have conceived of the damage that Hurricane Katrina would inflict. I do not have any interest in revenge for the impeachment of Clinton or for promoting one party over another. But if Bush and Cheney are not impeached, removed from office, prosecuted, convicted, and imprisoned, we will have removed impeachment from the United States Constitution and sanctioned aggressive wars in the near and distant future by this and other administrations. The rest of the world understands this. Look at Bush's welcome in India and Pakistan. You know, there are people who think that Bush's negligence before and during Katrina by itself is sufficient grounds for impeachment. There are others who say the same thing about the ports deal, or about the leaking of classified intelligence, or about the manufacture of phony news, or about the retribution exacted on whistleblowers, or about the pre-9/11 negligence, or about the war crimes, the targeting of civilians, the use of chemical and nuclear weapons. There's also the ongoing manufacture of biological weapons and the refusal to investigate the 2001 anthrax attacks. The Center for Constitutional Rights has laid out a comprehensive case for four articles of impeachment, and it does not include anything I've just mentioned. It doesn't have to. It focuses instead on the spying without court approval, the use of torture, the imprisonment without charge or trial, the illegality and fraud of the war, and the numerous violations of the separation of powers. Our impeachment cup runneth over. The question, once again, is what are we going to do about it? We have reached smoking gun fatigue. We have new memos and testimony every week on the war lies. We have Murray Wass in the National Journal yesterday, two more memos. People are tired of the evidence and want to know what we're going to do about it. And we've been collecting all of this evidence at afterdowningstreet.org. I don't know if I need to tell you this. You know, there are 27 members of Congress co-sponsoring John Conyers' bill to create an investigation into grounds for impeachment. Several of them are from California. Not a single one is from my state of Virginia. I'm coming to speak where I'm not needed. But the governor of Virginia has spoken up for impeachment, saying, quote, guilt wherever found ought to be punished, end quote. Sadly, that was Governor Edmund Randolph in 1787 arguing for making impeachment central to the system of checks and balances in our Constitution. Two other Virginians, George Mason and James Madison, came up with the language, treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Not just treason or bribery, but abuse of power is grounds for impeachment. My neighbor, Thomas Jefferson, thought that impeachment was central to giving the legislative branch the power to check the executive and judicial branches. The legislative branch, of course, writes laws. 322 times in American history, prior to Bush, a president has signed a law and written a signing statement explaining what he thought the law should mean. 435 times George W. Bush has done that. And in doing so, he has rewritten the laws he's signed. As a result, torture is self-defense, war is peace, and dictatorship is democracy. To those who think we can end the war without impeaching Bush and Cheney, I would ask, what will you do when Congress finally ends the war and Bush signs a statement clarifying that the war will not end?
I know that what's been said here will engender some questions. I just want to ask one. My son worked for Tom Daschle and was one of those exposed to anthrax. Fortunately, he and all of the others recovered because they got immediate medical attention. Five people who worked for the United States Postal Service died because they didn't know what was wrong with them. And the lady in Connecticut, an older lady, you mentioned something about anthrax. What do you think the government's failure has been as a follow-up to that letter being mailed to the senator's office?
Well, at this point, there isn't any follow-up. The FBI is not investigating. And from that, you need not draw the conclusion that the FBI did it. It's enough to know that the federal government is illegally developing biological weapons, which were almost certainly the source of the anthrax that was mailed. And so that is sufficient explanation for the need for a cover-up. What our government needs to do is to cease manufacturing biological weapons and return to supporting the Biological Weapons Convention. You know, these are very, very difficult things to produce, and the production for offense is exactly the same as the production for defense, where you develop the weapon, you see if it works, you develop the vaccine to protect your troops or to protect your citizens, and it is extremely unlikely that an individual could develop what was used in those letters. And in fact, there were five laboratories that traced that anthrax to Fort Detrick's lab. But the FBI has destroyed the stock, so the evidence is gone. I think it is absolutely disgraceful that we are launching a war based on, among other lies, the lie that Saddam Hussein has biological weapons. He no longer had the ones we gave him under Reagan. And at the same time, we are manufacturing them. That needs to stop, and there needs to be an investigation of the most serious attack in Congress in history.
The question was, why didn't the American public know that the U.S. military was never really in there in any great numbers to affect what needed to be done in Afghanistan? And indeed, they were, if I may interpret your question, that they were being held back for something else. Yeah, well, that was part of the strategy, that the administration did not want the U.S. public to know that they had already made the determination that they were going to be going into Iraq. And so they nickel and dimed the military operation in Afghanistan. You know, the first people on the ground, and the ones that were there for a full month before the U.S. military got there, were the CIA, paramilitary operators with the CIA, who used the Afghan Mujahideen to actually do fighting against the Taliban and to a limited extent against al-Qaeda. But by the time the U.S. military finally got in there, a good month after the CIA, the al-Qaeda guys had already gone back up into the mountains into Tora Bora. They had already started filtering back into Pakistan, where they still are. You talk about all of the duplicity of what's happened, the duplicity of investigations that need to be going on right now, for example, the anthrax, the investigations of what should go on about what happened in war crimes in Afghanistan, where the United States, in my opinion, was complicit in the murder of thousands of Taliban. They weren't good guys, but they didn't need to die by torching the bottoms of the prisons that they were in, or shooting into convoys of trucks where they were being loaded into and then taken to prisons. There are a lot of war crimes that this administration must be held accountable for, because it is horrendous what's going on in our name. And then you talk about these things of torture, rendition. You talk about we as Americans, honestly, are the last to ever know anything. The rest of the world seems to know it all before us, because as much as I appreciate being here in a television studio to have a conversation like this, one has to acknowledge that our own national media does a pretty pitiful job of letting us know what's going on.
Throughout this whole discussion today, I was sitting back there saying, don't we live in a wonderful land whereby we can agree to disagree? Nowhere in the world, not even in Great Britain, can we have the freedom we have to express ourselves as we do. This is America. Let's give them another hand.